I'm sure you've heard the story of one of the earlier examples of Solomon's wisdom. The two women, two harlots, quarreling over whose son was the one still living. Let's just review that story. It's a good example of wisdom, but it's a good example of something else that I want to emphasize. 1 Kings chapter 3. 1 Kings 3. We'll review this in the introduction. Verse 16, now two women who were harlots came to the king and stood before him. And one woman said, O my lord, this woman and I dwell in the same house, and I gave birth while she was in the house. Then it happened the third day after I had given birth that this woman also gave birth, and we were together. No one was with us in the house except the two of us in the house. And this woman's son died in the night because she lay on him. So she arose in the middle of the night, took my son from my side, while your maidservant slept, and laid him in her bosom, and laid her dead child in my bosom. And when I rose in the morning to nurse my son, there he was, dead. But when I had examined him in the morning, indeed he was not my son whom I had borne. Then the other woman said, No, but the living one is my son, and the dead one is your son. And the first woman said, No, but the dead one is your son, and the living one is my son. Thus they spoke before the king. Now, how are you going to solve this? And the king said, The one says, This is my son who lives. Your son is the dead one. And the other says, No, but your son is the dead one. My son is the living one. Then the king said, Bring me a sword. So they brought a sword before the king, and the king said, Divide the living child in two, and give half to one and half to the other. Then the woman whose son was living spoke to the king, for she yearned with compassion for her son, and she said, O my lord, give her the living child, and by no means kill him. But the other said, Let him be neither mine nor yours, but divide him. So the king answered and said, Give the first woman the living child, and by no means kill him. She is his mother. And all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had rendered, and they feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. So it is an example of wisdom, an example of something else. And that something else is fairness. The one woman thought it would be fair to divide the child. And isn't that normally what is fair? If you have something and there are two people claiming it, why not just split it? It reminds me of a time when we were hunting and was in question whether a friend and I had shot some elk, two elk, or some other people had. And their idea was, Well, we'll just let you take one, we'll take one. Now, we knew that we had actually hit both of the elk. We had broadside shots, and they did not. They had straight-on shots. And interestingly, and this to me was rather amazing, after we decided we didn't want to argue about it with them, we were going to let them take one of the elk, and he started field dressing the one elk, and then they changed their minds. They said, No, you can have both. We realize that you had much more likelihood of hitting these, and I'm still amazed to this day that that concession was made. So you normally think what is fair is to divide it down the middle. Not always. And there's another aspect to this that we need to talk about a little later in the sermon. So these women disagreed. Solomon made a wise decision. So it is in the world today. What one person thinks is fair, another does not think is fair. None of us would see eye to eye in every situation as to exactly what was fair. But especially in the world, people have different views of what is fair. Solomon had an uncanny ability to bring out the truth. And that is one of the most essential ingredients to fairness, being able to see things as they are. To ascertain the facts and to understand and perceive them. Being able to see a person's motives for what they are is also a very important factor. So today we're going to discuss something that is very important in all of our lives and relationships. Fairness. And specifically, are you fair? Am I fair? Are we fair, equitable, just people? We know God is, but are we? Now, could you imagine the modern version of these two women arguing over a child? One woman would be suing the other. The other would countersue. Each would have a lawyer. Months of litigation would probably be involved. Following the outcome, there would be an appeal. It would probably be featured heavily on television. One of the parties might flee to another state with the child, the one that happened to have him at the time. The matter might never get resolved, or at least take a long time. The judge would certainly not make a decision to allow the possibility of cleaving the child in two with a sword. Not that Solomon would have done that. He had something else in mind, obviously. But modern man thinks God's ways are not fair. Ezekiel chapter 33. Ezekiel 33. Many scriptures about the unjust judge, which is not so much what this is about, but you've read those scriptures about the unjust judge, and truly we see that fairly often. Verse 14 of Ezekiel 33. Again, when I say to the wicked, you shall surely die, if he turn from his sin and does what is lawful and right, if the wicked restores the pledge, give back what he has stolen, and walks in the statutes of life without committing iniquity, he shall surely live, he shall not die. Now, if you steal something and you're caught, but then you give it back, are you going to get off in today's system of justice? No. Not at all. God said, if this person repents, he shall not die. None of his sins which he has committed shall be remembered against him. He has done what is lawful and right. He shall surely live. It is here a matter of life and death. Yet the children of your people say, the way of the eternal is not fair. But it is their way, which is not fair. When the righteous turns from his righteousness and commits iniquity, he shall die because of it. But when the wicked turns from his wickedness and does what is lawful and right, he shall live because of it. God's way is one of mercy, not a letter of the law approach that is going to require the last bit of skin you have before you are allowed to go free. Yet you say, the way of the eternal is not fair, O house of Israel. I will judge every one of you according to his own ways. That is one example of God's system of fairness, of judgment, of equity. If a person repents, he is forgiven and comes under the blood of Jesus Christ. Have you ever known anyone that thought God was unfair to them? I have. I've known several people that way. I remember talking to one in a little town called Zapata. Anyone ever hear of Zapata, Texas? Or know where it is? Anyone know where Falcon Reservoir is in Texas? Probably. No? Amistad? Okay. Falcon is the old reservoir before Amistad came along. For many years, Falcon was the big bass fishery, and I think Amistad kind of took that over. I think Falcon is up or downstream on the Rio Grande, but Zapata is a little town near Falcon Reservoir. Small place in those days, probably a little bigger now. This woman kept talking about how unfair God was. And this is unfair, and that's unfair. I asked her, well, do you think God was unfair to Job? Oh, yes, he was very unfair to Job. Was God unfair to Job? I'll say a little bit about that in a moment. But I've known a few individuals who had some difficult times in life and concluded that God was being unfair to them. It's an attitude that we must be perceptively on guard against and never allow to arise, because it can take us to a very dangerous place. If you stop and think about it, this is how Satan set the whole scheme of deception in motion. And one way to describe what happened in the Garden of Eden is that the serpent, Satan, convinced Eve, first of all, that God was not being fair to keep the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil from them. So she and her husband with her set about to adjust the situation to fit their idea of what was fair, that they should be able to partake of this tree. When you begin to consider God's dealings in your life and consider something is unfair, you have to be very careful. Do not let yourself get into that frame of mind. You're playing with dynamite. You're toying with losing salvation. Instead, work to better your lot in life by correcting your mistakes and working through the problem and doing what you can to resolve the situation. Ask God for the resourcefulness and the wisdom in promoting fairness. But unless you know the facts, unless you know the way things are, you cannot administer or decide or perceive fairly. To find the truth and get all the facts about something can sometimes take some doing. As a matter of fact, we humans are woefully inadequate when it comes to consistently being able to dig out everything that's pertinent. As far as resourcefulness and wisdom, let me give you an example. Now, this has to do with dealing with children, but has broader applications than that in principle. Let's say that there's a small ice cream cake, just a little one, just about big enough. See, Jim looking at Jackson, but we'll make it a little bigger. Let's say it's just big enough for two children. And it's going to be cut in two. And it's set up so that one of the children is going to cut the cake and the other gets to decide which piece he's going to eat. It's a kind of an interesting setup, don't you think? Obviously, in this case, the one chosen to cut the cake will be motivated to cut the cake into two sections that are just as equal as he can make them. If he cuts one piece smaller than the other, he figures that the other child is going to take the bigger piece. And that's probably correct, although not always. Sometimes children learn a little better approach to things, and you go ahead, you have the bigger piece. But normally speaking, based on human nature, the one who chooses which piece will take the larger one. In one sense, the outcome is fair. Would you not agree? Two nearly equal pieces. Can't get it down to the molecule, obviously, but can probably cut it fairly evenly. However, does this approach instill a godly attitude of fairness in the children? I don't think so. Because fairness, to be godly, must involve an attitude, a frame of mind. And this affects adults, not just children, obviously. In this example, the children do not even have to think about generosity or what is fair in the sense of being kind to others. It only goes to the point of needing to involve self-interest. The result is fair because it's even. But is there a spirit of the law being involved here? I don't think so. A strategy like this can prevent an altercation, big disagreement. Oh, your piece is bigger than mine. You should have given me the big piece. Fairness in a godly way must go a lot further than that. It must go far enough that we're willing to take the short end. Fairness is of course, a huge issue in the world of human beings. There's a feeling that is very widespread, prolific in our world. I'm not being treated fairly. I'm not getting a fair shake. He isn't treating me right. It's not just children. Certainly it is children too, but it is adults. They think they're getting a bad deal. They're not being treated fairly. If a parent is not fair, the child picks up on it right away. And fairness is very important to young people. I've found that out by having teenagers and by working with teenage groups over the years. Found that being treated fairly is of tremendous importance to them. And they're pretty perceptive. They know when they get a raw deal. If there's partiality, a young person picks up on it right away. It should also be said that sometimes, though a child may think something is unfair, when in reality it is fair. That's another aspect to the situation. But not getting our way does not mean it's unfair. We don't have to get our way for things to be fair. Maybe what's fair is for us not to get our way in some cases. It was mostly due to partiality that Joseph's brothers sold him into slavery. He was the favorite. It's pretty clear in the scriptures. He was the one given the coat of many colors. The others knew exactly where things stood. They perceived it very well. And so they sold Joseph into slavery, and God worked with it to bring about his plan, but there were some wrong attitudes here. Some of the brothers were more upset and vengeful than the others were, and in fact, Joseph would have died had, Judah not stuck up for him. There is, I believe, a significant caution here for young people. When you let yourself get bent out of shape, when it seems like life isn't fair, and people aren't fair, and you try to take matters into your own hands, you can cause a bigger problem. You can experience a bigger problem, and or cause a bigger problem for other people. It is simply a fact of life that life is not fair. That's the way it is. And yet, in the long run, it'll turn out fair. But every human being is going to be the recipient of a number of unfair acts, situations, circumstances over the years of his life. Probably quite a few of them. There was something attributed to Bill Gates. This goes back a few years. Some of you probably read it a few years ago. 11 points that purportedly Bill Gates made in a speech at a school. It was Mount Whitney School in Visalia, California, where he supposedly delivered this speech. And Bill Gates actually never delivered that speech or made these points. On the other hand, the points, I think, are pretty interesting and applicable. I don't want to read all of them, but I do want to read three of them. These points are still pretty good, I think. Number one was, life is not fair. Get used to it. And then whoever said this, and Snopes.com never was able to trace down who actually did say it. That's the page you can get on to find out if a story that's being circulated is true or false. Although I think sometimes even Snopes gets something wrong. But life is not fair. Get used to it. The average teenager uses the phrase, it's not fair, 8.6 times a day. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe it is. But looking back on my life, when I was a teenager, I feel very sure then I said, it's not fair, a whole lot more than I do now. I would concede that. So, listen up, teenagers. But we all do this. Adults do this as well. It's not fair, or that wasn't fair, or he didn't treat me right. They made a wrong decision. There's preferential treatment here, and so on and so forth. This point goes on to state that one reason teenagers are this way is because they got it from their parents, by the way. Follow their example. Then I'll read rule number 5. Flipping burgers is not beneath your dignity. Your grandparents had a different word for burger flipping. They called it opportunity. They weren't embarrassed making minimum wage either. They would have been embarrassed to sit around talking about Kurt Cobain all weekend. You can tell this is a few years old, talking about Kurt Cobain. And then number 10, television is not real life. And by the way, how many of you think that reality shows are really reality? I don't. Television is not real life. Your life is not a sitcom. Your problems will not all be solved in 30 minutes minus time for commercials. In real life, people actually have to leave the coffee shop to go to jobs. Your friends will not be as perky or pliable as Jennifer Aniston. Again, it kind of dates this because I think it refers back to the sitcom Friends that was on TV for a number of years. Something I never watched a complete episode. Not embarrassed to say that, but I never watched might have watched a few snatches here and there. So I thought that was a little interesting in relationship to today's subject. Again, life is not going to be fair to all of us at one time or another, probably many times in our lives. We need, of course, to deal with unfair situations, improve whatever part of it is ours that we can improve, and our response to it, and move forward. And let me give you a quote here. This is from an unknown author, but I like the quote. Expecting life to treat you fair because you are a good person is like expecting a bull not to attack you because you're a vegetarian. Now, Numbers chapter 15. Numbers 15. Verse 32. This is one of the passages that some people read and conclude that the God of the Old Testament was a harsh monster. Very, very unfair. And when you know the details of this situation, you realize it was not unfair in the least. Numbers 15, beginning in verse 32 through 36. Now while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. And those who found him gathering sticks brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation. Now they put him under guard because it had not been explained what should be done to him. Then the Eternal said to Moses, the man must surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. So as the Eternal commanded Moses, all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him with stones, and he died. Was he just picking up a few little twigs or little tiny sticks to make a little fire to get warm? No. If you look into this, and there's a companion account, you'll find that he was gathering major fuel on the Sabbath and likely was doing it to work on the tabernacle and the heating and smelting of metal, to work with metal, to do major work on the Sabbath day. It's an interesting example in terms of showing that if you try to serve God by breaking his law, or while you're breaking his law, or serving by breaking it, you're not really serving him. It's not justifiable to break God's law using the pretext, well, I'm doing this to be of service to God. that does not work with God. Other than that, the priesthood, the Levites, did do service to God on the Sabbath. There were sacrifices that were offered. There was work that was done. Parallel to that is today when God's ministers, in a sense, work. The Sabbath is the hardest work day of most ministers, especially when you're pastoring 2, 3, 4 churches. Mr. John Pinelli is pastoring 4 churches, Salt Lake City, Grand Junction, Calgary, and Edmonton. And he, of course, flies up to Edmonton to take care of those churches. So at the end of the day, sometimes you're a little worn out. But that is done in a way that God commands, and not talking about someone taking it on himself to serve God in the way he chooses. So was this harsh? No, it wasn't, because here was a bad example being set. If God had not stepped in, this would have been like the proverbial rotten apple in the barrel. It would have spread to the other apples, and after a while, the whole barrel would be rotten. Also like the situation in Corinth in 1 Corinthians 5. Had that immorality been allowed to go on, it would have spread, already was spreading, in the Corinthian congregation, and there would have come to be a much larger problem than there initially was. So God was wise, and this was not a tiny little violation. This was major, once you understand what the individual was doing. But people read it in a very cursory sense, and then they conclude that this Old Testament God was harsh, and I'm sure glad we have this benevolent Jesus Christ in the New Testament, not knowing that it was the one who became Jesus Christ who was the God of the Old Testament who dealt with Israel. Man looks at the individual. He looks at the immediate situation. He doesn't look at the big picture. God looks at the greater good in the long run, and he looks at the seriousness of the transgression. All these were factors. Man looks at the current victim, even if he brought it on himself. And one thing that is so interesting and maybe a little bit upsetting to me is you can have someone like James Holmes. And everybody knows that he is the one who shot those people in the Aurora Theater. But he's still the suspect. He's a suspect. This does not reflect God's fair system of governance. God doesn't look as much, or man rather, doesn't look as much as he should to other potential victims. So you have people getting out of prison before they should. God understands the rotten apple spoiling the barrel principle. Man is getting further away from that. And what happened to this individual here in Numbers stood as a warning, an example to others, and helped to maintain the integrity of the entire nation. And two, what people don't stop and think about is that this man will be resurrected. He'll come up more than likely in the second resurrection. He'll probably be very sorry for what he did, will have learned a very important lesson, and may end up in God's kingdom with eternal life, depending on his choices, of course. Now, if you'd look at Ecclesiastes chapter 8, just one quick verse here that gives us a good principle. Ecclesiastes 8, verse 11. Ecclesiastes 8:11. Because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore, the hearts of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. And this truly applies to our modern system where cases string on for weeks and months, sometimes years. Another passage, Numbers 32. Fairness, I believe, is one thing God had in mind when this stipulation was delivered to the Israelites, Numbers 32, beginning in verse 1. Numbers 32:1. I'll read down to verse 6, and then a couple of other verses later in the chapter. Numbers 32:1. Now the children of Reuben and the children of Gad had a very great multitude of livestock. Now here were two tribes that had a propensity to be cattlemen and sheep herders and the like. And when they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, this was on the east side of the Jordan River, that indeed the region was a place for livestock. The children of Gad and the children of Reuben came and spoke to Moses, to Eleazar the priest, and to the leaders of the congregation, saying, Ataroth, Dibon, etc., etc. Verse 4, the country which the Eternal defeated before the congregation of Israel is a land for livestock, and your servants have livestock. Therefore they said, if we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants as a possession. Do not take us over the Jordan. And Moses said to the children of Gad and to the children of Reuben, and it later came to include a half tribe of Manasseh. And I found that interesting, speculatively. I wonder if that has anything to do with a certain proportion of our population having gravitated toward the western United States or toward ranching and farming and things of that nature. That's just a very general observation, but what is important to note is that God put a nature in various individuals to be adept and to be inclined towards certain types of livelihood so that there would be a balance of the various skills that were needed for a successful nation. So Manasseh then was added to these as well. And so Moses said, shall your brethren go to war while you sit here? No, that would not be fair, Moses is saying. Now down to verse 20, 32:20. Then Moses said to them, if you do this thing, if you arm yourselves before the Eternal for the war, and all your armed men cross over the Jordan before the Eternal until he has driven out his enemies from before him, and the land is subdued before the Eternal, then afterward you may return and be blameless before the Eternal and before Israel. And this land shall be your possession before the Eternal. But if you do not do so, then take note you have sinned against the Eternal, and be sure your sin will find you out. And that's a very good verse which some have committed to memory. Be sure your sin will find you out, unless you totally repent of it, of course. So what is being said here, the requirement is that to be fair, you have to go over and help the rest of the Israelites defeat the enemy and get established in the land on the west side of the Jordan. Then your men of war can come back and live here. That is fair. That is what has to be done. And God, through Moses, even showed that for them not to do that would be considered sin. So sometimes being unfair is tantamount or reaches as high as becoming sin in God's way of viewing it. Now, people might think, as I indicated a little while ago about the lady I dealt with down at the little town of Zapata, might think that God treated Job unfairly. You know, Job had a pretty rough go of things for a while, suffered tremendously. However, there are a few points that people forget, and this lady I visited, this must have been in the late 60s when this happened, some points that show God was not unfair to Job. Number one, the only way for Job to learn a vital lesson that could potentially have made the difference in salvation or no salvation for him, God had to deal with it. The only way. Is that fair? If God has to do something to you that may seem unfair to you in order maybe to jar you from your spiritual laziness or lethargy or to get you away from a sin that you know better than to do, in which if you don't repent, could get to the point you're going to lose salvation. You know, if God does that and you have to suffer a little bit, is that unfair? Well, that's the most fair thing I can think of that he could do. A second point about it, Job himself concluded that God was fair in the long run. In the short run, he didn't. But he learned his lesson and he realized just how fair God was. Thirdly, God gave Job twice as much as he had before, and his children who died will be resurrected. There's that aspect that people forget, that there will be a resurrection. Now, what is fairness? Former Associate Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart, deceased for a number of years now, but he said this: fairness is what justice really is. Fairness is what justice really is. And our God is a just God, an equitable God. No one knows more about justice than God. His judgment is just, it is fair. Here are some things that fairness is that help define it. Number one, playing by the rules. Well, that's one of the main purposes of a set of rules, so that fairness can prevail. Can you imagine playing football without any rules? Or basketball? I remember back in Austin, Texas in the 1970s, there were a bunch of us young men. I was a young man at that time. And we used to play basketball on one of these outdoor courts. And there were rules, but there was nobody enforcing them. And we had some of the roughest basketball games you could imagine. Sometimes I wished we had a referee with those games. And there were times when I said, hey, guys, let's settle down a little bit here now. No doing like this to the guy that's coming after you when you want to make a basket, or the guy that's going to make a basket, you do that to him. So you have to play by the rules. The purpose of the rules is to promote fairness. Secondly, taking turns. Let everyone have a similar opportunity. That's one of the hard things to get through to children who are very young, to take turns. Thirdly, sharing and listening to what others have to say. If you're going to treat others fairly, you've got to hear their side of it. There has to be balance in this. That is relative to the person's age and position. I wouldn't say that in every situation a person should get equal time, but whatever rules of fairness apply, they need to be applied. It certainly does mean that one person shouldn't shut everyone else out and dominate a situation. I heard of a situation recently where an individual had an excellent idea for something that should have made a lot of money and could have, and some billionaire investors got involved and they decided just to squash this individual and take over the idea, which evidently wasn't patented, and the results for the small guy were devastating. So we do have to be careful in those ways. Number four, not taking advantage of others. This is something Christians should be very careful about. I've seen it happen again and again and again in the church over the last 40-some years. But we need to be very careful not to take undue advantage. We should help each other and we should accept help. Yes, that's part of being brothers and sisters. But we have to be careful and realistic and perceptive about taking advantage of others and not do so. A fifth thing that fairness is, considering all sides before a decision. Not necessarily just two, because often there are more than two sides. Consider all sides before a decision. And six, not blaming others for what they did not do. Find the truth, get the facts. Be careful. You don't blame someone unless you're absolutely sure they're guilty, and then You still need to be like Jesus Christ and like Stephen when he was stoned, that the sin not be attributed to the individual. Some rules of fairness. Number one, emphasize that fairness is just as important on the giving end as it is on the receiving end. Going back to the example of cutting the ice cream cake in two. We want to be treated fairly, but we must treat others fairly, generously, and even be willing to go above and beyond and take the short end of the stick, take the smaller portion. Number two, avoid favoritism, such as Jacob did toward Joseph. Thirdly, listen to others, including children. If you want to treat your children or just treat children fairly, listen, because sometimes what they have to say could play a major part in making a fair decision. Number four, in dealing with children, let the punishment fit the crime. You can apply that in certain ways to the adult world as well. Now to bring it a little further into the level of the spirit of the law. We shouldn't stop with the principle of devising a way to help children share the cake equally unless we also emphasize the way of give. And that, in the case of cutting the cake in two parts, it would be a great opportunity to begin to teach that in the child's language, whatever age he is, of course. God doesn't just want us to be sure everything is exactly equal in every situation, because many times the pieces will already be cut anyway, and they won't be equal. But he wants us to be willing to let the other guy have the advantage. Reality states that a child will not cut two perfectly equal pieces anyway. And if he doesn't, wouldn't it be nice if the other child said, well, look, you can have the bigger piece. I'll take this little piece. It takes a little bit of coaching to get to that point, doesn't it? Many times we're in situations to which this principle can apply. Reality states that we're all going to be in a situation where it's not possible to divide it evenly, and we have to take the short end. With children, it's not taught automatically or quickly. It may take a period of time. But the spirit of godly fairness and equity would have us to be more than fair, to use that term, to be willing to give something up for our brother. So the spirit of the law most definitely has an application to fairness, equity, and justice. Fairness is a trait that, if we exemplify it, will bring respect. You know, people respect fairness. Young people respect fairness. But fairness in its spiritual application of going above and beyond and giving your brother a little more is an attitude of mind that will elicit respect, and much more than respect. Things like admiration, appreciation, and love. We might say this approach is like being a profitable servant in the realm of fairness. Giving more, taking less. A beautiful trait of Christianity, part of the way of give. This is God's way of dealing with us, in conclusion. This is why we didn't receive what would be the letter of the law fair, which is death. God has dealt with us bountifully. He has given us much more than is fair from a human perspective. We need to learn godly fairness, developing a spirit of generous fairness toward other people, and we need to learn more thoroughly with each passing year the skills of getting the true facts and using those facts justly. Also, to develop resourcefulness and wisdom in exercising fairness. Then ultimately, we will have the spiritual perception to begin to exercise fairness and justice in the same manner as the Messiah. Familiar passage, Isaiah 11, verse 1 through 5, this well-known millennial passage. Isaiah 11, verses 1 through 5. There shall come forth a rod from the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. The spirit of the Eternal shall rest upon him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Eternal. His delight is in the fear of the Eternal. He shall not judge by the sight of his eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor. All of this he will do in total fairness and generosity. And decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall slay the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt of his loins, and faithfulness the belt of his waist. So maybe you and I can gain some ground in practicing a greater degree of fairness in our lives as Christians in preparation to being fair kings and priests and judges in the world tomorrow, with this most fair of all beings, Jesus Christ, who is the Son of his Father and thinks as he does.